the region rose. A former Department of Defense official says Jordan knows how to please Capitol Hill.
We used to call them, when I worked in the Pentagon, the new Israel, because they were so good at getting what they needed.
David Shanker is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. On a recent trip to Jordan, he heard familiar complaints that the kingdom is fighting ISIS because the U.S. and Israel say to. He worries this now feeds a militant message.
The kingdom right now is arresting hundreds of suspected members of ISIS. And eventually, these cells, what they call, you know, sleeper cells in the region, somebody will succeed in getting off a terrorist attack in the kingdom. And then, you know, the word will be that, you know, this happened because we participated in the coalition.
The arrests take place under Jordan's new anti-terrorism laws, which the group Human Rights Watch says are too vague and could be used to stifle legitimate expression. Jordanian analyst Labib Kamhawi says support inside Jordan for Islamist groups, including ISIS, stems from limits on political freedom and high taxes, prices, and unemployment.
So you have all these generations of young Jordanians unemployed with no prospect for employment. And this is why you see the spread of pro-ISIS tendencies.
Jordan does have a problem with many young men leaving to fight for Islamist groups in Syria and Iraq. But like the U.S., Jordan says it has no intention to send regular ground troops to fight on the other side, contributing intelligence, some bombing runs, and training instead. Emily Harris, NPR News.
Thanksgiving Day was relatively quiet again in Ferguson, Missouri. There were just a few protests and a scattering of incidents. Many demonstrators hope that the death of Michael Brown, the young unarmed black man shot by white police officer Darren Wilson, will be a turning point in race relations and policing. NPR's Martin Casti has been talking to police, trainers, and other experts looking for signs that police forces are acting on lessons learned from Ferguson.
It's been a bleak year for police. Besides Ferguson, there was the death of Eric Garner, tackled by officers in New York. And in Ohio, police stormed a Walmart and shot a black man who was chatting on a phone while holding a BB gun. When the International Association of Chiefs of Police held their annual meeting in October, they sounded worried.
Police chief after police chief in these working meetings were repeatedly talking about the fact that we're at a crossroads.
Michael Neela is a former officer and founder of Blue Courage. It's a reform-minded training program that teaches police to think of themselves as the community's guardians. He says there's huge demand for his services right now.
There are a lot of dynamics that are different about this time that we're in the spotlight, and it's causing police executives to think about what we have to do differently.
A lot of reformers are saying things like this. Russ Hicks is an officer with 23 years on the job who now teaches at Washington State's Police Academy.
Now's the time to really look at our culture and to become better, to look at how we're connecting with the community. Our profession needs an upgrade.
But what lessons exactly should police take from Ferguson? Reformers tend to agree that the police were too provocative and confrontational with protesters back in August. But what about the actions of Officer Darren Wilson? Is there a lesson to be learned from his shooting of Michael Brown? Here, the reformers hesitate.
I think it's counterproductive for society to focus on individual incidents.
Peter Moskos is an associate professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and he's also a former policeman.
Partly because I think we're picking the wrong examples to use, and partially because they are just individual incidents. I mean, there will always be some bad police shootings.
Moskos says if he were to nominate a case study of a bad police shooting, he wouldn't pick Michael Brown. He'd pick LeVar Jones. He was the man shot at a gas station by a South Carolina state trooper in September. Shot and wounded while complying with the trooper's commands.
Why did you shoot me?
Well, you dove head first back into your car.
I'm sorry.
The problem with drawing lessons from the shooting of Michael Brown is that it's not this clear cut. Protesters say Officer Wilson was in the wrong, but police tend to think he was in the right. The slogan, "I am Darren Wilson," has become an expression of police solidarity. Earlier this week, the chief in Portland, Oregon, had to tell several of his officers to take the slogan off their Facebook pages.
It is very, very dangerous to pick a fight with the police.
That's Michael Neela again, of the training company Blue Courage. He says when you're trying to change a police force, you don't want to alienate the officers. And that's the danger here, especially if officers think the post-Ferguson message is that they're no longer trusted and they're no longer allowed to defend themselves.
If you're a line-level cop who works the street, you feel like you're under attack. You feel like you're under attack. You feel like you're under a microscope. You very likely feel like there's a no-win situation. So what happens with street-level cops in these type of environments is they sit back and they do the minimum.
Tackling a police department's internal culture is such a delicate task that some reformers say it may prove easier for departments to just go with fixes that are bureaucratic and technological. More paperwork and body cameras. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Let's turn now to some proposed changes in how the U.S. documents marital status. Thanks to questions about marital status in the U.S. Census, we know that the divorce rate for older Americans has doubled in recent decades, and that a record number of people who are currently married are on their second go-round. But the U.S. Census Bureau now says it may stop gathering those numbers. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Trends aside, knowing who's married, divorced, or widowed in a given year is helpful for government agencies. The Census Bureau's James Treat says the Social Security Administration makes the most use of it.
So they use it in their actuarial analysis as they're projecting spending rates out into the future based on benefits of survivors, widows, divorced couples, those kinds of things.
But Treat says the administration can get what it needs from states. It does not need local data from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, and it does not need two other questions. How many times have you been married? When were you last married? In fact, Treat says those are problematic.
There was some complaints associated with asking this information and why we needed to obtain it.
So people didn't like you delving into their marital background.
Correct.
Americans are funny that way. I mean, we crave this information, and yet we are reluctant to provide it ourselves.
Philip Cohen is a sociologist at the University of Maryland. He points out marriage is in dramatic decline. Families are growing more complex. Having people's marital histories helps researchers understand such shifts and who's affected.
Such as, what are the ages? What are the education levels in race or ethnic groups? What's happening with same-sex couples?
After 2007, Cohen matched marital histories with births and employment status.
We really were able to track the impact of the Great Recession on families in a way that would not have been possible without this data.
The public can comment on whether to drop marital history questions until the end of the year. The Census Bureau will make a final decision next spring. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:18, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Allegations of a shocking rape at a University of Virginia fraternity party continue to shake that campus. Coming up at 8:33, we'll talk about the history and the power of America's college fraternities. It'll be snowy at times today, maybe even some light freezing drizzle, with most highs in the 20s.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market in the lobby of the Roadie, 514 56th Street, featuring Wisconian delectables, handcrafted sweet and savory chips, and salsas and maple syrup. For the complete vendor list, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com, Saturdays from 9 to 1.
The UW Jazz Orchestra and featured performer Ingrid Jensen. WPR is pleased to support music education and performance. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Things are calmer on the streets of Afghanistan's capital today, a day after multiple bombings and bursts of gunfire. The attacks included one against a British embassy vehicle that killed five people, including a British national. NPR's Sean Carberry says militants targeted an area of Kabul housing foreign embassies and workers from international agencies and companies.
While it's quiet in Kabul for the moment, there's violence around the country. A bomb exploded in a mosque in eastern Afghanistan, wounding dozens of people. And in southern Afghanistan, militants are trying to storm an Afghan army base. It had been the largest marine base in the country until last month when they turned it over to the Afghans and left.
In the south of France, they're dealing with floodwaters because of heavy rains.
Television footage is showing helicopters rescuing people with lifelines. One father with his little girl was waiting with other parents at a school trying to get children out who had taken refuge on the second floor because the first floor was completely flooded.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. At least one person has been killed by flash floods there. As parts of New England deal with the cold and power outages, there's record heat in Southern California. The National Weather Service says temperatures reached 86 degrees in Los Angeles yesterday, 85 in San Diego. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin shoppers filled the stores to take advantage of the early Black Friday bargains on Thanksgiving Day. A few stores stayed open the entire holiday yesterday, while most larger chains opened at 5 or 6 last night. That's still a couple of hours earlier than last year. A lot of stores waited to open until this morning, though, and shoppers can still expect big crowds and new bargains today. The National Retail Federation says the average Black Friday shopper spent $407 last year. Academic staff in the University of Wisconsin system received a total of $17.3 million in extra duty pay last year after lawmakers lifted a limit on academic overtime. The overage, also called overload, rose 18% across the UW system for the entire 2013-2014 academic year. Overage is pay for academic responsibilities that go beyond a base workload. Overage had been capped at $12,000 per calendar year prior to July of 2013, but the limit was not always enforced. It's been almost 33 years since a female body was found attached to a floating pier in the Milwaukee River. To this day, no one knows who she was. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office has just issued a digitally reconstructed photo of what the victim might have looked like. They call her Jane Doe, 1982, a 5'4" African-American who could have been anywhere from 15 to 35 years old when she drowned. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. From the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. With the only question worth considering this morning after Thanksgiving, are you having turkey for breakfast or waiting for lunch? Okay, plus, is the stuffing too dry for a second day helping? Leftovers, they're both a delight and a challenge, which is why we turn to author and celebrity chef Nigella Lawson for her suggestions. Our colleague David Green reached her in London.
Nigella, thank you for coming on the show as always. It's great to talk to you.
It's nice to be here.
I just want to clear something up very briefly. You are British.
I am.
You are, though, qualified to guide us through what to do with leftovers in this very American holiday.
Well, actually, the holiday of Thanksgiving is not dissimilar, in essence, to the way we celebrate Christmas Day. You know, with all big feasts, I love the leftovers. I feel that you only really feel you're at home when you have leftovers, and there are so many leftovers after Thanksgiving, and so many different sorts, that really the heart leaps.
My heart always leaps, but one of the problems I always find is that I am so exhausted after Thanksgiving dinner, I don't really know where to put all the leftovers. I mean, there have to be some tips you can give us on how to store. I mean, where should we put these things to make sure we can actually use them and they don't go bad?
I certainly think that as much as possible, you want to separate all the different foods, unless you eat it all together. I have to say, one should never, ever disparage a sandwich of cold turkey, cranberry sauce, and cold stuffing.
Okay, so sandwiches are one way to repurpose leftover turkey. What are some other ideas?
Well, actually, I like going slightly less trad, because I think one's had this fantastic traditional ritual of a feast.
Mm-hmm.
So when I use up my leftovers, I will make one of those wonderful Vietnamese dipping sauces, which is really minced garlic, chili, some of the nam pla, the Vietnamese fish sauce, some lime, bit of water, teeny bit of sugar, and I whisk that together, and then I just shred some turkey. I might add some sugar snaps, but the crucial thing for me are those glass or cellophane noodles. So you're making something that feels so light and so different from the feast you've had before that it feels really not like you're using up leftovers, but something entirely different.
Glass noodles, turkey, Southeast Asian style. I never would have thought of that.
A lot of cilantro. It's a really great way of using up turkey for the same reason. When I was younger, so many fashionable restaurants had something called bang bang chicken on the menu, which was basically a chicken salad with an awful lot of Chinese style peanut sauce. So smooth peanut butter with some chili, Chinese chili sauce and black vinegar. And it coated it quite thickly. Now I do bang bang turkey. I always feel like that's exactly how you feel after you've had all your family gathered. So it could be as an appetizer, or it could be great if you had a baked jacket potato, but basically it's the same thing that you're pairing the turkey with ingredients you don't customarily think would go with the turkey. Otherwise, it is just cold cuts again and people moan.
Not everyone moans, though. Some people want to go more traditional, trad, that's the word you used, right?
Yes, and I do that a lot because my children love pies. So if I have a ham and turkey leftovers, I make a rather rich white sauce, a bechamel. I use turkey gravy if I've got some left over, mix it with some whole milk. I have been known to add cream, and I make a pie. You know, you can put peas, you can even do some leftover vegetables, but there was something so gorgeous about that buttery, flaky crust and the rich white sauce, velvety interior. And actually, you don't really have to eat it all now. You could make the sauce and put the turkey in it, and you could just put that in the freezer, and at some later date you could thrill everyone with a turkey pot pie.
Nigel, you said something very, very pretty, and I'm not going to phrase it perfectly, but you said something like there's nothing like leftovers to make you feel like you're home. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that a fridge that has just little bowls of leftovers, you feel this is a home, people live here, and there's always the wherewithal to eat, whether it's standing up by the refrigerator or by some alchemy of turning these leftovers into another meal. And I love that feeling. I hate waste, and I think using up leftovers makes me feel that I cook, whereas cooking with ingredients from scratch sometimes doesn't give quite the same satisfaction.
Leftovers have never sounded so good. Nigella, thanks so much for coming on. It's great to talk to you.
And you.
That's cookbook author Nigella Lawson talking to David Green. She returns to TV next week as one of the judges on the new season of ABC's The Taste. Okay, it's Black Friday, and you know what that means. Stampeding customers crashing through doors, elbowing and shoving to get in on some incredible bargains. These kind of doorbuster sales are not a recent phenomenon. It turns out crowds were lining up for deeply discounted items as far back as the 19th century. We asked linguist Ben Zimmer to look into the history of the term doorbuster. He says one story traces it back to the 1890s and a Philadelphia-based department store called Wanamaker's.
They were selling calico for a penny a yard, so that was a big savings, and it happened to be at a time when calico dresses were very popular.
Shoppers couldn't wait to get in on the deal.
So there was a big crowd that rushed in to buy the calico. And in the process, the window of the door to the store got smashed. And the story goes that a store official there at Wanamaker said that bargain certainly was a doorbuster.
So in the 21st century, if you want to avoid this...
I just got hit in the face with a bag.
Or this... Not that I'm recommending it, but you could skip the brick and mortar and shop online.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The rapper Killer Mike knows people will make assumptions about him.
I'm a black male in America, and we have been used as characters for villainy and monsters well before I was here.
Down with the shame, down with the shame. Used to walk trapped in the rain with
the hip-hop phenomenon Killer Mike, later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Right after classical music this afternoon at 3. See our complete schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. The holiday lights keep going out at the Cincinnati Zoo, and it's not the zookeepers flipping the switch. With the zoo holding its annual Festival of Lights, large patches of the park keep plunging into darkness because something is chewing through the light displays. Not lions, tigers, or bears, it's squirrels. Zoo officials have tried spreading hot sauce on the light strands to no avail. Apparently, squirrels like it spicy. You're listening to Morning Edition.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. It's 8:31. The passenger pigeon is long gone, but its memory is staying alive. It's a slice of Wisconsin life we'll bring you at about 8:45.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a place to call home. Familiar voices, timely conversations, uplifting entertainment. Nearly 500,000 listeners tune in every week, benefiting from the programs made possible thanks to WPR member support.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
This is Michael Leland, WPR's news director. I spent part of my career living and working in Washington, D.C., and I'm returning there this spring on a WPR-sponsored motor coach tour led by Holiday Vacations. We'll stay right on Capitol Hill. We'll see monuments, museums, and even stop at the world headquarters of NPR. The trip leaves April 7th. Details and registration at WPR.org/travel.
Our weather forecast today, cloudy with highs mainly in the 20s. It'll be snowy at times, and there is a slight chance of some light freezing drizzle mixed in. Overnight lows in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow should be the nicest day for the foreseeable future. Partly cloudy with highs in the 30s and low 40s.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk
Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org. From the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest provides ongoing support to NPR and to member station KPBS in San Diego. And from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of public radio listeners all across America who support their NPR member stations.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Allegations of an appalling gang rape at a University of Virginia fraternity party continue to shake that campus, and that story adds to growing concerns about the level of sexual assaults on college campuses, and it's led to calls for a ban on fraternities. We reached Nicholas Surrett to find out how fraternities came about in the first place. He's author of The Company He Keeps, A History of White College Fraternities. He says they emerged in the 1820s.
Fraternities started as secret organizations, not just secrets in that they kept secrets, but secret from the faculty themselves. And they largely did so as a way to sort of assert independence in the face of a faculty that was pretty regulatory. So fraternities were a way for them to do something that was rule-breaking against the sort of rules of the faculty.
How then did fraternities go from that underground status to being a prominent part of college life?
In part, it was that some of the people who became faculty had been in fraternities themselves, and they insisted on a sort of more public presence of fraternities. But it's also that colleges grew, and fraternities started to perform functions for colleges, like provide housing and that sort of thing.
And also, I would gather, a network that would be started in your student life and go on to be really helpful in, say, business or politics?
Absolutely. From, I would say, the 1850s, fraternities were pretty self-conscious about the degrees to which membership was national, and that joining a chapter at one college then made you brothers with the men in the chapters at another college. And this was helpful in a country that was expanding, that was urbanizing. So if you moved from one place to another, you were assured of a network of people who might be helpful to you.
Now, of course, we're talking about this because fraternity membership is correlated with some pretty disturbing behavior. What does research tell us about fraternities and things like drinking, hazing, and sexual assault?
Sure. So in terms of drinking, the research I did certainly shows that there's a long history of drinking in fraternities, and the research of others demonstrates that fraternity men drink more than non-affiliated men. In terms of hazing, there's a good deal of history of hazing in fraternities. So the first hazing death occurred in 1873 at Cornell University, and reporters have demonstrated that between 2005 and today, 75 students have died in fraternity-related deaths. Other researchers have demonstrated that fraternity men are more likely to participate in sexual assaults, and my research certainly found a connection between fraternity men's emphasis upon sex really escalating by the 1950s through the present.
Well, from what you've just said, maybe we should turn around the question that we posed, that I posed in the introduction, not should fraternities still exist, but why should they still exist?
I think they still exist, in part, obviously, because the people who join them find them to be beneficial and fun, so there is a great demand. And then the people that graduate from fraternities end up becoming powerful alumni a lot of the time. So most studies have shown that people who have been in Greek letter organizations are more likely to donate to their campuses once they have graduated and to be active as alumni. So when universities start to talk about the possibility of changing, modifying, or eliminating fraternities, they often get a lot of pushback.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Surratt is an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Colorado. He is the author of The Company He Keeps, A History of White College Fraternities. And women in Kenya are facing an extreme form of harassment almost daily. For the past 2 weeks, their street mobs have publicly stripped women for wearing clothes the men deemed too revealing. The attacks are shared on cell phone videos, inspiring a cycle of assaults. NPR's Gregory Warner reports that they're also sparking unprecedented activism for women's rights. And please note, this report contains graphic and disturbing sounds of violence.
At a crowded bus station in downtown Nairobi, a guy in a checkered cap directs men and women into buses headed to all corners of the city. His name is David Awar. Ask him how he feels about women in miniskirts, his face fills with disgust. Their clothes should be ripped off completely, he says.
They should be stripped.
Yeah.
On November 10th, at this same bus station, a woman was stripped naked and pawed by dozens of men. It wasn't the first time in this rough part of town, but this episode was captured on cell phone. The graphic video prompted some approval on Kenyan social media. The miniskirt, illegal in some African countries, has been portrayed in the press as a foreign, European blight on traditional African fashion. But just around the corner from the bus station, in a narrow stall stocked with brightly colored fabrics, Marion Njambi does a brisk trade in women's clothes.
What dresses are the best selling?
Miniskirts, mostly.
Miniskirts are most
yes.
popular?
Not tight trousers.
This is our country. We have to wear it wherever you want it.
And then she pulls out her cell phone and calls up the latest assault video that she downloaded just that morning. There's been a new video, a new victim, almost every day.
Have you seen this?
And a warning, this video is and sounds very graphic. This one is set inside a bus. The woman's canary yellow dress is hiked up, and the cell phone camera eye zooms in as her legs are forcibly spread open by some of the male passengers. These widely shared videos have sparked a national soul searching in this predominantly Christian country. Hundreds of demonstrators chanting, "My dress, my choice," took to the streets of Nairobi last week to demand a government response.
People, I think it's because, yes, it was filmed. Kenya is now having a conversation around violence against women. For the first time, I must say, in a very long time,
Kavina Macau is a program officer at the human rights group Equality Now. She says these videos in Kenya have triggered more anger and more calls for change than any other episode of sexual violence.
It is an opportunity like no other for state officials to address in very concrete terms the issue of violence against women in Kenya.
But she says the same viral videos that are galvanizing activism are also inciting copycat attacks of increasing violence. In a subsequent video, a woman was beaten. Another was raped with a beer bottle. Each new video, she says, sending a message to would-be perpetrators.
Nothing happened to those people that were involved in that act. And it's the impunity around it and the fact that people know that they can get away with it that this continues to happen.
Authorities say that they can't arrest people if the victims don't come forward. The National Bar Association, called the Law Society of Kenya, is requesting special permission to prosecute the crimes in their place. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
And there's more international news coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up. In 10 minutes, we'll tell you what happens now that OPEC is not going to cut production. Once again, that's coming up at 8:51. Our weather in Wisconsin today, cloudy, snowy at times with a slight chance of light freezing drizzle and highs mainly in the 20s. Some patchy fog as well tonight with lows in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow should be a nice day, becoming partly cloudy with highs in the 30s and low 40s. That should be it, though. We expect partly cloudy highs near 30 on Sunday, and then colder temperatures early next week with highs in the teens on Monday and mainly in the 20s on Tuesday. Right now, Superior 10, La Crosse 18, Wausau 9, Madison 18, Green Bay 12, and Milwaukee 18 degrees. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Stores and shopping malls are crowded on this Black Friday, with people across the U.S. looking for deals on toys, clothing, and smartphones. In London, shoppers at one store were pushing and shoving their way to boxes of flat-screen TVs.
Guys, seriously, you need to calm down before someone gets hurt, yeah?
Please!
So everyone take one TV out of line, that's it!
Other shoppers say they prefer to wait for Cyber Monday to take advantage of online discounts without the crowds. Thousands of homes and businesses remain without power in Maine and New Hampshire after this week's snowstorm. Outages are also reported in New York State. Parts of the Midwest are seeing snow today, but nothing heavy.
There are some winter weather advisories in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, eastern North Dakota, and into Wisconsin for some light snow. Otherwise, we are looking at some lake effect snow showers in the lee of Lake Erie and Lake Ontario.
That's meteorologist Brian Hurley at the National Weather Service. Christmas trees are expected to cost more this year. The Oregon-based Pacific Northwest Tree Association says it's good for growers that weaker demand and lower prices have come to a halt after 6 years. The group says many growers went out of business during that time. On Wall Street at last check, the Dow was up 23 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. University of Wisconsin-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank is paying $95,000 a year to have somebody write her speeches. One state lawmaker says it goes to show the university does not need more money in its next state budget. Former broadcast journalist Amanda Todd spent 21 years as a spokeswoman for the state court system. Former state personnel chief Peter Fox says Todd is a wonderful writer who got caught up in a bidding war between the UW and the state Supreme Court. Blank created the speechwriter's post to help her focus on public outreach. Republican State Representative Dale Coinga of Brookfield, who's a member of the Joint Finance Committee, says that the big paycheck shows that the UW does not need any of the $133 million increase in tax funding it's asking for the next 2 years. Madison police say the wearing of body cameras by officers might not generate the public trust in law enforcement that many may think. Some officers in Wisconsin's capital will start wearing body cameras in 2016 as part of a pilot program. Next week, police will give a report to the Madison City Council which questions whether it would be worth the estimated $1 million price tag. A man has surrendered after barricading himself in a church near Madison overnight. The Verona Police Department says it responded to a burglar alarm at St. James Lutheran Church late last night. Officers arrived to find a broken window. A SWAT team and a hostage negotiation team brought the situation to a close without incident early this morning. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. From CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks. Online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. And from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. 100 years ago, a passenger pigeon named Martha died in captivity at the Cincinnati Zoo. She was the last of an indigenous species that once numbered in the billions in North America, particularly in Wisconsin and Michigan, where flocks could actually block out the sun for miles. Gone but not forgotten, faculty at Beloit College are getting students and the community excited about passenger pigeons once again.
We've been talking about passenger pigeons for a year. I mean, we're kind of like the crazy bird people on campus.
Hello, passenger pigeon fans. Thank you all for being here tonight, and welcome to Ghost Flock Flyover.
And what we find is that a lot of people don't really know the story of the passenger pigeon. So we'll say, yeah, well, we're doing this commemorative event about passenger pigeons, and we get this kind of blank stare.
But I'm going to ask y'all to use your imagination a little bit. This is from Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac, and what I'll be reading is On a Monument to the Pigeon.
My name is Dan Bartlett. I'm the curator of exhibits and education at the Logan Museum of Anthropology at Beloit College. Well, the passenger pigeon as a species at one point was probably the most numerous animal in North America, and they estimate 3 to 5 billion birds at one point. And they moved around in flocks of hundreds of millions.
Men still live who, in their youth, remember pigeons. Trees still live who, in their youth, were shaken by a living wind.
And in 1871, the largest passenger pigeon nesting ever was recorded in Wisconsin, where a flock stretched in something like 800 square miles in central Wisconsin, kind of centered on the area of Wisconsin Dells. You could not shoot into a flock without hitting some, and trappers devised ways to net them hundreds at a time. We reached a point where their population could just simply no longer sustain itself, and the population collapsed.
This song is called Pretty Bird. It's really sad.
Fly away, little pretty bird.
Humans are the reason that the passenger pigeon went extinct, and so I feel a certain amount of, I guess, residual responsibility for what we did to that bird.
Little pretty bird.
September 1st of 1914 is when Martha, the last of the passenger pigeons, died. And the centennial of that death, I mean, it's one of the few times where we know the date, the time, and the place when a species has gone extinct. It's not a one and done kind of thing. I mean, we're doing this same thing to the North Atlantic fisheries. We're overfishing cod and other species to the point where there's a real possibility that their populations will collapse.
Cold running spring.
You know, it's 100 years on, but we could still do the same things to other species that we did to the passenger pigeon.
Love's own tender flames warm this meeting.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. Find out more at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up in just a minute, and the best in classical music begins at 9 o'clock.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
For people like Vernon G. Stitch of Madison and dozens more. Hi, I'm Mike Crane, Director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join the effort at WPR.org/veterans.
Our weather in Wisconsin today, it'll be cloudy, sometimes snowy, and there is a slight chance of some light freezing drizzle mixed in. We expect highs mainly in the 20s. Add some fog to that mix tonight with lows in the teens and low 20s. Tomorrow is shaping up to be the nicest day for the foreseeable future. Partly cloudy skies with highs in the 30s and low 40s. And temperatures will start to get colder again early next week.
Support for WPR comes from Bremer Bank, with a new location in La Crosse and with other Western Wisconsin Bank locations, dedicated to helping businesses, building relationships, and strengthening communities. BREMER.com. Member FDIC. Support also comes from Candina's Chocolatier, dedicated to the creation of fine confections with equal parts artistry, science, and love. Candina's has retail stores on the Capitol Square and on Old PB in Verona, and is available at Candina's.com.
Have oil producers in Montana and North Dakota unwittingly become unofficial members of OPEC?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The oil producers' cartel OPEC yesterday decided not to produce a drop less of oil. Today, the market reaction in the U.S., with the West Texas benchmark price down 5.9% this morning to $69.36 a barrel. The OPEC move is seen by some experts as a message to non-OPEC members that it's up to them to cut production if they're worried about the falling price. Robert McNally is president of the energy markets consulting firm The Rapidan Group.
We were thinking that OPEC might say, well, we're not going to cut now, but maybe we'll have a meeting in a couple months just to check. Instead, OPEC took the most severe form of a challenge to non-OPEC producers. They basically said, we are going to keep producing at the level we're at now next year, period.
Non-OPEC competition among those competitors are producers of shale oil in the United States. And with oil below $70 a barrel here, this really is going to hurt the economics of the domestic production.
Well, that's right. Shale oil, relative to other types of production, is relatively sensitive. It responds to price signals more so than other forms of production. That's because of the steep decline rates in shale wells. And that's what OPEC is counting on. They kind of make shale oil in the U.S. sort of like a forced member of OPEC, if you will. OPEC basically told the United States, you guys are effectively new members, and you're going to have to adjust your production to help balance the market. We will not do it all by ourselves.
Robert McNally is at the Rapidan Group. Mr. McNally, thank you for this.
You're very welcome.
ExxonMobil stock is down 3.2% at the moment. Chevron is down 4.6%. Let's do some more numbers. The S&P 500 is down 3 points, not quite 0.2%, to 2,069, but the Dow is up 37 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ also up, this one 0.1%. The 10-year Treasury yield is down at 2.21%. Thanksgiving is usually the heaviest travel time of the year. This week, U.S. airlines expect to carry 24 million passengers. That's up 1.5% from last year. From Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports on an often overlooked tool that could help people avoid some travel nightmares.
A lot of people just don't know that social media can be such an amazing tool.
Brian Kelly is a frequent flyer mile ninja and founder of thepointsguy.com. He says people can turn to Twitter to upgrade seating, find lost luggage, or rebook flights. When he was traveling last New Year's Eve, his flight had a mechanical delay.
And I was in my seat on my phone getting rebooked via Twitter with the American Airlines team while passengers were trying to run off the plane to get reaccommodated first.
Kelly got the last seat on the next flight. Most U.S. airlines now have teams dedicated to helping customers via social media. Scott Sorensen works in Southwest's Listening Center in Dallas Love Field.
Comments, complaints, or questions. So, hey, my flight's delayed leaving this city.
am I going to make a connection in my next city?
Sorensen can often get back via direct message to the customer, sometimes in a matter of minutes. So if you're looking for a fast response, Sorensen and Kelly say start by looking up the Twitter handle for your airline. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at FordFoundation.org.
I suspect that many of us would prefer us to randomly play a little more Miles Davis or something rather than listen to more about so-called Black Friday shopping, but we should talk about the safety of your credit and debit cards if you're using them today, this weekend, or on Monday, the day consumers are pressured to shop online. With more on that, let's turn to the host of our sibling program, Marketplace Tech, my colleague Ben Brock Johnson. Good morning, Ben.
Hi, David.
All right, so we're told it's okay to use the boss's computer to shop on this Monday. You think it's going to be a big one?
It is. Last year, 2013, Cyber Monday was the biggest online shopping day in the U.S. in history, right? $1.7 billion spent. So it's kind of a big deal, this online shopping day.
You know, but it is just about a year since, we would later learn, Target was getting its computers hacked and personal information and credit card and debit card stuff stolen on a colossal scale. You think this is going to scare off cyber shoppers?
I think a lot of people are concerned about this. We should note, of course, that the Target hacks, as we think of them, were actually point-of-sale hacks. They were happening inside brick-and-mortar stores. So in some ways, it's not happening online in the ways that we think it is. But people are concerned about this. I've seen some surveys that are estimating this year we're going to see a leveling off of Cyber Monday. Part of that could be the simple fact that, like, physical retail stores, e-commerce sites are starting shopping deals earlier and earlier. A few surveys, though, have said people have increased fears about hacking, and so some of those fears are warranted. Zscaler is a company that measures online attacks. They say hacking attacks have grown steadily throughout November, just as online shopping transactions have grown.
Now, the retailers would have seen the same surveys. They've also seen the cost it's been to retailers like Home Depot and Target that have faced the hacking. I assume they're trying to harden the system.
Yeah, they are. One advantage that online retailers have, David, at least, you know, from some perspectives, is that they have had at least 10 years to make really strong security on their websites. It's a lot cheaper, right, to improve the security on your website than it is to go in and retrain all of your physical employees in physical stores and things like that. But another thing that we should remember is a lot of websites today will actually just be making sure that their site doesn't crash from traffic because they're offering some insane deal. So part of it is they're trying to improve the way their sites run. Watch out for that kind of thing.
All right, they don't want like this web 1.0 old school, the site is down because too many people are pinging it trying to buy the latest offer kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, David.
And George Lucas filmed part of the first Star Wars in the desert of Tunisia, but then the sand buried a lot of it. Today, the BBC's reporting on efforts to dig up the old Tunisian sets and patch them up to attract tourists. Some of the money's from the Tunisian government, some from online crowdsourcing. And if you can't get all the way to Tunisia, try the Golden Canyon hike in California's Death Valley. That's where Lucas filmed his hooded Jawas with the glowing eyes. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. APM, American Public Media.
And I'm Norman Gilliland, in for Stephanie Elkins on this Friday. And we'll have some treasures, too, and you won't even have to do any digging to find them. We'll have jewels, for example, musical ones provided by composer Emanuel Ferrari in the hour to come, and that's just the beginning. It all starts in just a few seconds right here on WPR.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Wisconsin Historical Society, taking history on the road, crisscrossing our state with the Wisconsin History Tour, sharing stories one community at a time. More at wisconsinhistorytour.org.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, presenting Good Tidings of Great Joy, based on the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, Saturday evening at the Siena Center in Racine, and again on Monday evening, December 8th, at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford. Tickets at choralartsonline.org. You're listening to W.